Fanning. Weekends on 2FM.
Big Sur is what it's called. That's from The Thrills. And Daniel Ryan from Zing Guitarist is here now. Daniel, how are you doing? Are you all right?
Good, thanks.
Good man yourself. Now, before we get into the song, the band, how and when did this all start, The Thrills?
It started really when I was 14. I lived next door to Connor, who was the singer. My family had moved back from London when I was just before I turned two. And Connor was living in the house next door to where we moved into. So we kind of found music together, really, and formed a band at 14. And the band really never changed after that.
Yeah, the band was, I mean, it was Reader's Wives or something. What were they called again?
We won't go there. But I suppose the name The Thrills came together in 2000, the summer of 2000.
Right.
We were in San Francisco and we had spent the previous summer in San Diego. And the kind of...
Inspired by that,
yeah,
off you
very
went.
Much, yeah, very much,
yeah. Yeah, and like the West Coast of America was always a big thing to do with anything to do with liking The Thrills, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, big time, yeah. So Big Sur and the session for the debut album. When was the song written?
The song would have been written around 1999, 2000. Kind of a lot of the songs on that first album were kind of written in bits. You know, some of them maybe came together as full songs, but this was definitely one of the ones that was kind of pieced together from different
bits. Was it written over there? It wasn't. It was written here.
Yeah, no. It's kind of hard to pinpoint because we had bits. But there was even songs on the second album that started over there, you know.
Yeah. And Connor was doing whatever he was doing. You were playing a bit of banjo and it just kind of took off. Is that it?
Yeah, the banjo was kind of a bit of an accident, really, because a friend had given us a lend of a banjo and we used to rehearse quite quietly. But when we weren't in a rehearsal room, we would rehearse in Connor's house. So we would have no drums or anything like that set up. So we would just kind of have maybe a couple of acoustic guitars and work on our vocals, and that's how the banjo came along.
Yeah. Because, like, you know, here comes the part that I ask all the time. I just think it's a stupid question. What's the song about? And don't give me a Bob Dylan answer, because Bob Dylan said, what are my songs about? Well, some of them are about 10 minutes, some of them are about 5 minutes.
It's not really... Connor's probably a better place to answer that, but the kind of album in general, the theme for us was kind of being back here in the winter and kind of really wishing we could get back there.
Yeah,
over to America, and that's obviously where we went to record the album.
Yeah, and you went to record the album there because at the time I think it was one record label was looking out for you, and then they started getting momentum, and every record label was looking for you. So you could pick and choose, and you picked Virgin.
At the time it was Jeff Travis who started, who runs Rough Trade, and he had kind of just signed the Strokes at the time and the Libertines, so he was very hot at that moment. And but through, you know, meeting various record companies, we settled with Virgin, and they were run by a French managing director called Philippe Ascoli, who had signed Air. He had that label Source,
right,
which had really actually signed Gemma Hayes as well. And he just kind of really seemed to love what we did, and we kind of liked what he was proposing for us. And when we went to meet him, his wife was pregnant at the time he was trying to sign us, and he said, because he couldn't fly, he flew us over to London. We played a couple of songs in the record company, and we went into his office, and I said, before we have a chat, we want to make sure if we sign to you that we can record an album in America. And he said, okay, that's no problem.
So, in other words, you had artistic freedom, you could record the album in Hollywood, which you did, and you could get Tony Hoffer, who you wanted, as a producer.
Yeah, that was Philippe's idea, because he had worked with Air a little bit.
And I mean, he did Beck
he
and
did
Air.
Beck.
That's two of the tops, from my point
of
view.
And that was a big selling point for us. Yeah.
And how did it work with him? Did you like working with him in the studio?
Yeah, I mean, I think you think when you go in that everything is going to be great, but we definitely clashed a little bit. You know, I clashed with him a few times. And I suppose as well for me, you'd been in the band since you were 14, and then you were going to, as someone else was kind of stepping in for 6 weeks, it does feel a bit weird.
You were giving away some of your in chargeness.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
So, like, I mean, like, lots of great things happened in terms of being nominated for Mercury Prizes, but in the year Dizzy Rascal won, and, you know, the 03, you got the Best New Act in Q Magazine, Meteor Awards nomination, and all the rest of it, et cetera. In fact, you won one, I think, of that, didn't you?
Yeah.
And then there was the EBBA thing. Isn't that the one? outside of your own country
yes.
award or something.
Yeah.
So you won loads of awards and everything was happening really good. So just going back a little bit, you had been to Holly Park School in Dublin and that's where you had met first, right? The whole band.
No, that's always kind of grey. Myself and Connor went there. Porrick, who was the other guitar player, we met through his sister, and then Kevin had met Connor in secondary school, and that was kind of how it all came together.
But the actual influence, the sound of the Thrills to me was always like classic US pop, late 60s, Sun, Sea, Surf, Beach Boys, Monkees, all that kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, I think as well at that time, I mean, at that time you think you know everything about music, but we were only just 20, and you had to really go looking for music then. You know, you bought a CD and you were stuck with it for till you could buy your next one, you know. So it kind of forced you to really, really look around. And that was something I think we did in America. And we, you know, the influences were just coming thick and fast.
And well, like, I mean, we picked the song Big Sur. I mean, we could just as easily have picked Santa Cruz, couldn't we?
Yeah. And
might that have even been bigger in some ways?
As a song?
Yeah, in terms of its success or in terms of its reach.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. In some respects, I mean, that was kind of the first single. And then One Horse Town came and that went top 20 in the UK and that kind of got us on Top of the Pops, and that kind of really, I think that surprised even the record company.
Yeah, so you come back to Dublin and you're thinking of the West Coast of America and around like Big Sur, like, I mean, it's just a beautiful place. It's ridiculous.
It's stunning, yeah.
It's outrageous. Yeah. I went there once and went to a thing which I looked at a cabin. I was pointed out that this cabin was bought by Rita Hayworth or something, or Orson Welles or something, and they never lived there, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful... That West Coast is stunning. Yeah. You know,
and also the people who really should be doing this kind of thing is the Beach Boys. And but they did. But they really, the really weird thing was they did it all on an album that they made in Holland called Holland, which is one of the most underrated albums of the year. It's just brilliant. And they had, you know, Santa Cruz or whatever it's called. What was it? No, California Saga.
Yeah.
And Santa Cruz was in all that. That's absolutely brilliant. Okay, so you were always influenced by that kind of thing. The first album did really, really well, right?
Yeah.
Okay, the second album, tell me about that. And then the third one, Teenager.
Yeah, so the first album, you know, would have kind of sold over a million copies around the world. And that would have definitely not been something that was expected of us. And I think that really raised the stakes for the record company.
Did it give you a big head?
No, not really. No. To be honest, you're too busy. You know, when we went off to record the album, we really didn't get back for... You came back for a couple of days here and there, but I think when you're in the band, you're kind of 6 months ahead of everyone else. You know, the album is coming out and you're already working on songs for the new album. You're thinking about a tour that's booked 3 months away that no one else knows about. So there's so much stuff coming at you that I just, for me, certainly, you just don't have time to think about that.
Yeah, I mean, like, also with the second album, Let's Bottle Bohemia, you had some people in the Van Dyke Parks in there doing orchestrations.
Yeah.
Now, he's the number one, Beach Boys and Randy Newman and, I don't know, like, Little Feat and Ry Cooder and every Grizzly Bear, right up to everybody. So, like, did you work with him or did he
Yeah,
work?
We did. We were in his house. Yeah.
Oh, you didn't just give him the songs and off you go?
All right. No, we spent a good bit of time with him.
What was he like?
He was lovely, yeah. He was said he couldn't remember a lot of stuff from back in the day.
He had a good time in the 60s is what you're saying.
Yeah, we went to his house and then he came to the studio. We spent maybe half a day in the house with him while he was working on stuff. And then he came into the studio and he was brilliant.
He's like a huge name and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and we had Tom Petty's keyboard player. He came down and played on a couple of songs as well. Yeah.
And Peter Buck, he's on the album from R.E.M.
Yeah, we played in a venue called the Crocodile in Seattle, and we were huge R.E.M. fans because, you know, in 94, that, you know, 92 to 94, they'd really kicked off into the mainstream.
Yeah, up to Monster, yeah.
And we were playing in the Crocodile in Seattle, and we were standing outside before the show, and Peter walked up and said hello, and I just, after the show, he was in the dressing room, I said, can I get your number, you know, keep in touch, and then I sent him a message a couple of months later, we're going to be making the record, we're in the studio if you fancied popping down, and he said, yeah, I'll come down for a day. So yeah, he was really, really cool. We toured with them a bit, so kind of got to know them quite well.
Yeah, and also Ron, Ron Wood wasn't. Yeah. Was he on?
No, he. We did a live performance with him of Maggie May. We played a couple of shows with the Stones when they did the, you know, the tour where they did an arena and a small venue.
Steel Wheels or something.
It was 40 Licks time.
All right,
and they did. We played a venue in London called the Astoria, which held 1,100 people with them. And then you would play the bigger, you know, the point type venue as well.
All right.
Yeah.
And also the OC on TV, which was huge. What was used on that by the Thrills?
Was
it a medley of songs?
It was two songs from the second album. It was Not for All the Love in the World and A Saturday Night.
So you went to LA to do the first album, and you went there again to do the second album.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Now, was New York the third album?
New York was the second album as well.
Oh, was it?
Third album was Vancouver.
Oh, right, I see. Yeah. That's called Teenager, right?
Yes.
All right, okay, yeah. And then there was The Thrills, The End of Innocence. Was that kind of a collection or a best of? Or
yeah, that's all that was, yeah.
Right, yeah. So, like, in 2008, did you break up or did you never break up?
No, we didn't. We've never broken up, no. Just things like, you know, slipped apart, you know.
Yeah.
But not necessarily with us. When the second album came out, the first single really didn't chart as high as I think the record company and radio thought it would. And we just lost the support of radio, which we had an amazing support from BBC up to that point. And without it, we just kind of disappeared, really, you know. It just...
It's the story of 1,000 bands.
Yeah.
It really is, you know.
Yeah.
But that third album, you had Tony Hoffer back, right, for album number 3. Okay. And you said that you went to Vancouver. Was that therefore the place where wait a minute, what's your man's name?
Brian Adams.
Brian Adams owned a morgue.
That's it, yeah.
and you recorded in a morgue, did you?
Yeah, if you know Vancouver, there's an area called Gastown, which apparently originally was the centre of the city, which was full of wooden buildings. And there was a big fire in Vancouver over 100 years ago. And that was the only brick building in the city. So it was the only building left standing. So that's where all the dead bodies were brought. And that was on the advice of REM. They had recorded quite a bit there. And they had said, this is a great place to go. You should... Yeah. Had the desk from George Martin's studio down in the Caribbean. I think he'd bought that desk.
Really?
And so it was a really, and it's such a beautiful city as well, you know.
Yeah, there's no, what do you call it? I don't know. There's no time limit for anything. Like, some things happen and they just happen over a period of time. The Thrills often seem to me to be quite quick. I mean, you were making demo tapes and then you were suddenly in Hollywood making an album, or is that not the way it was?
Not for me, no. I mean, I was probably going into you when I was 15 and I used to wait outside the studio and give you a tape when you were leaving at the end of the night. So
that was you.
I think when it came together for on the outside, maybe it looked very quick, but definitely not for us.
Yeah. Like, would you have listened to stuff? Like, obviously, you mentioned Air. Would you have listened to Phoenix and Belle and Sebastian and stuff that Tony Hoffer had done?
Yeah, Phoenix, Philippe, who signed us, had signed Phoenix as well. So we actually would have met them. We would have, you know, crossed paths quite a bit. Kevin and the Thrills is a huge Belle and Sebastian fan. And Stuart came to a couple of our shows.
All right.
And, I think the guys knew them a bit better. I wasn't a huge fan of theirs. I liked them. Wasn't a huge fan, but...
But like, you know, you'd be rehearsing through the night behind Supermax in Dublin and suddenly you're in Hollywood.
Yeah, it literally was just that quick because I think that summer when people started to get interested in us, we probably signed by the end of the summer, and then just by the end of September we were in LA and we came back to a sold out tour of the UK then.
Yeah.
That kind of before Christmas.
And the importance of radio at the time. I mean, Joe Wiley plays the thing and pushes it. I remember she was on one of the TV things of Glastonbury and says, you know, are you going to see blah, blah, and blah, blah headliners? No, I'm going to have to see the Thrills.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, that summer of Glastonbury, we were really kind of, it was really getting big. Yeah, so it was really kicking off then.
Am I allowed to ask them, where did it all go wrong?
Well, some people say that sometimes. They say, oh, you had two great albums, what happened? And I say, well, you didn't buy the third one because people just seem to forget about us so quickly.
I mean, at any stage now, would you go home this afternoon and stick a needle into the vinyl and see, like, so much for the city or whatever, you know, and just stick it on and see what it's like?
Yeah, there would be times where, you know, you might be flicking through your iPod and you see it and you put it on, or, you know, you're thinking about something and it just kind of prompts you to have a listen, or you have a conversation with someone, but not too often. Yeah.
The album was very successful. Was that pressure?
No, I think the pressure came really for us when the second album came out and didn't do well. Mm. And that really felt, it was funny because we would still play shows and the tours were kind of getting bigger. But then it just, by the third album, the tours weren't, we weren't selling the tickets anymore then, you know. So I think I don't know if I'd describe it as pressure, but it kind of feels like it kind of got to the stage where it felt like it really doesn't matter what we put out. And you know, like I was talking to Dan Hegarty a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying, like, your third album is the best album. A lot of people say that to us.
How often does that happen?
You know,
absolutely. I mean, there's certain bands, like, I think often the Charlatans or Supergrass or the Undertones, they got better and better and better as they went along, less fans as they went along as well.
Yeah, like, I have no doubt we could have made another great record, but you have to think that it's 2-3 years of your life, and it's a great process, but when there's nothing at the end of it, it's very difficult, you know. And then it's hard, it's kind of hard to be in that kind of, when your mind frame in music is challenged, you're starting to think, like the first record we did without anyone in our ears, you know, no one was saying, no, you should do this, you should try that. But when you get that little bit of success, like you said, you know, suddenly you've got all these people kind of coming into the studio, and you got a lot of people saying you should do this or you should do that. And sometimes you have to kind of remember, we got there without all that, so we got to trust ourselves. But then you hear about reviews, or you hear little comments like, if it was a bit edgier, it would be easier for the radio in America, and all those things, they kind of indirectly kind of, they do take a bit of a toll, you know. They do kind of filter in, and that's why I think you look at someone like Bruce Springsteen and you know, he goes and releases Nebraska, and against the advice of everyone, and it's the opposite effect for him.
Well, I mean, it's just like you know, OK Computer in 97.
Yeah.
And then what did they do? They brought out two albums that an awful lot of people are going, where is OK Computer 2? Well, this is just awful stuff.
Yeah.
And then now, 20 years later, greatest albums ever.
Yes.
Amnesiac and the other one. Yeah, so, I mean, like, you know, it can work both ways, as you say, all right, yeah. So you have been on hiatus since 2008.
Yeah.
So comeback time, anything, do you think?
Sometimes I think it would be nice to play a show. I don't know. I think it's 50-50 amongst all of us, you know. Sometimes I like the way we just kind of disappeared in a way. It kind of leaves a bit of a kind of a, you know, there's nothing definitive there. So, you know, anything can happen.
And the band never broke up?
No.
Right, okay. No. So what are you doing now? Any music projects on the go?
No music projects on the go at the moment. No.
You're happy in your nappy though, are you?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Yeah. All right, so like when it all happened, when you went, just one last time, I wanted to mention about REM. When they sort of, were they the ones who said to you, go to Vancouver because this is a good place to do it?
Yeah, we really clicked with them. We toured with a lot of, like, we toured with Oasis and they were great with us as well. But REM, we were 6 weeks around Europe with them. And you were really with them all the time, every day. There was no barriers, and there wasn't with Oasis or the Pixies either. But they were, you were going out for dinner with them, and you were listening to music with them. And I remember we were in New York once, myself and Kevin, and we knew that Mike Mills was there, so sent him a text, and he said, "Oh, where are you staying? I'll pick you up at 8 o'clock or whatever." And we jumped in the car with him, and he drove us to, he had a driver, but they dropped us to some bar, and we went in, and he had a word with the barman, and the counter came up, and myself and Kev and Mike in behind the counter into a room in the back, and there was a piano in there, and he was playing, he played about 10 REM songs for us, like Tongue, you know, songs that you know, because he wrote a lot of their great songs, you know, he's a fascinating guy.
Yeah.
And just like, you know, people,
he's not just the bass player,
I think that's what was so good about that band. Yeah. And I think a lot of people said when Bill Berry left, they're kind of, he was the kind of the ruler, really. He was the guy who got them into the rehearsal room every day, and he was their kind of compass. I think that they were really lost without him.
And what about Conor DC, Daniel, everybody else in the band?
Yeah, we're all great friends. Right. You know, I'm actually going to see Conor in America. He lives in London, but he's going to be in America in a couple of weeks, and I'm going to be there. So,
do you know, there's one thing that's always been just finally about Irish bands or bands from Dublin. There was a thing always like that. Most of the bands come from the north side, and the south side bands always had it really difficult. They're a band from the south side. They're obviously crap. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You have to overcome that. You have to be from the north side to be a band.
Yeah. Maybe that's what happened with the third album. Yeah.
Daniel, good man yourself. Yeah. So listen. Thank you very much indeed. Jeez, amazing memories that you'll have for the rest of your life.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about
times.
That.
Yeah. And the road didn't kill you, did it? It was great fun.
Oh, I loved that.
Yeah.
I mean, we toured all over America so many times.
Yeah.
And it was really, really, yeah, the touring is really the best part. It's kind of the bit you get to enjoy.
Yeah, right, yeah. Indeed. All right, well, listen, Daniel Ryan, thanks a million for dropping into us.
Dave Fanning, Weekends on 2FM.